Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to BookDub, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. Today, for our January book club meeting, we are talking about the final report of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. In other words, the report on Donald Trump's attempted coup. Joining me to talk about this, as well as potential indictments of the former president, are two attorneys. But don't worry, they're a lively duo. My guests today are Andrew Weissman, lead prosecutor in the Robert Mueller special counsel investigation, and an NYU law professor, and Jill Winebanks, Watergate prosecutor and the first woman to serve as general counsel of the Army. They are also both authors, Jill of Watergate Girl and Andrew of Where Law Ends. If you like what you hear, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And tell your friends. Let's dive in. Hey, guys. So Jill and Andrew, I thought I would share some fun things I have. And I just sitting around. So I know we're not doing video, so Jill didn't bother to adorn herself with a pin. But I have a pin for you, Jill.
Oh, good.
I don't know if you can see this.
Oh, my God, that's fantastic. I need that pin for my collection.
It says impeach Nixon, and it has the patina from the 70s. But there's more, Jill. Wait till you see this.
Okay, I have to take a break and go into my kitchen and get my favorite magnet.
Okay, look at this, Jill.
Oh, my God, that's fantastical.
So this is, it's like tin. It's like a trash bin that says Presidents of the United States of America. And, like, it's like this fake wood, I don't know, veneer. And then dead center is Nixon. I got this at a tag sale.
I see Kennedy, Washington, Johnson.
That's great.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
And then you've got, in case you don't know, your list of presidents. So this is so 70s. But so wait,
Jenny, when I grew up, in my room, there was a big bulletin board. And you know, it was in the 60s. And my parents were, you know, these Upper West Side liberals. And we had all these pins that were put on that bulletin board. And years later, I was asked to testify and before Congress, and it was my first time ever doing it. And I was on a panel, and the first person on the panel was Ed Meese. When I got home, my parents were saying, so how was it? And I didn't have the heart to tell them about Ed Meese, because all I could remember was a giant pin that they had that was in my room. That then the pin said, "Meese is a pig."
Oh
my God! But he was put on the panel to make you look great.
Wait, all I show was, you. I was just so like, my parents are going to think, "What happened? Well, how did we screw up?" And now he's on the same panel as Ed Meese.
So I'm going to show you a pin.
Wait, go put it. Oh, my God, Jill, I can't say that. Well, actually, I think I can say it. I'm going to read it out loud so Jill will not have to. This is a pin. She's holding up her iPhone. And it says, "They can't lick our dick." Nice, Jill. Thanks, Jill.
What can I say? I have a Nixon Lodge pin.
Oh,
anybody remember when he ran with Lodge as his vice president?
Yeah.
Wow.
People, when I wear that, think that it's a hotel named Nixon.
Have I told you my Nixon story? So I was born at the end of 1966. So when Nixon...
Oh, God. way to make me feel really old.
When Nixon was... I was like in elementary, like maybe second grade, I think, or right the beginning of third grade, right after Nixon. Yeah, between second and third grade when Nixon was impeached. And we had a carpool to school. And I remember I was in the back of Mrs. Zick's sedan. Maybe her daughter Susie was up front and my brother Adam was sitting next to me. And as the custom was, we were probably like hearing whatever she was listening to on the radio, making our own comments. And I said to my brother, "I hate Nixon." And Adam was about to respond something to me, and Mrs. Zick kind of glared at me, like in the rearview mirror, you know, you can see the evil eye of the parent. And she said, "Jenny Taub, in our family, hate is a spanking word." And my brother and I cracked up because the irony of, like, you know, violence against children. And so to this day, whenever we hear that, I never say I hate anyone, and we always say hate is a spanking word. But wait, I don't want to leave you out, Andrew, because I know I just showed Jill my Nixon stuff. But you know what I have? I have a Robert Mueller action figure still in the box.
Oh, wow.
There was not an Andrew Weissman one. I'm sorry about that. Also have, this is unbelievable. I'm so pathetic. I have a Robert Mueller votive candle, which if you can see, it was actually burned.
Oh my God. Unfortunately, it didn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then, so there's that. I'm out of the business of collecting figurines. I have nothing for Merrick Garland or Jack Smith.
Yet. There's still time to do that.
I have a Hillary Clinton nutcracker.
Oh my God, Jill. I went to George W. Bush's inauguration. My parents are Republicans and my mom was a politician for Michigan. And so I knew they were going to get tickets and I didn't vote for him, but I thought I want to go to an inaugural party. You know, I want to go to one before, because I figured we'd have the next president would be a Democrat for a long time. So I went down and I have a special George W. Bush inauguration bear. I'm a weird collector. I don't think that's what we're here to talk about. this is our monthly book club, and our book is a little bit unusual. It came out hot off the press last month, and it's the official report of the special committee to investigate the attack on the Capitol from there. Look at that. Jill has it from January 6th. And I have this version of it, which is just printed off the internet. And I thought a lot about how to have this conversation when I have you incredible, esteemed prosecutors. And so, I don't know. Here's what I'm thinking. Let's just imagine, if you'll bear with me, you know, back to the hypothetical. Let's imagine that Jack Smith, the special counsel, has made a recommendation to indict Donald Trump and maybe some other defendants in connection with the referrals made in this report. That's step one. Step two is Merrick Garland has looked at that and decided it's a good idea. And step three is I'm here. I've brought the two of you together because we've decided, me at the Department of Justice, we've decided that we want a team of prosecutors to actually bring this case to a jury. And you are the first team that we've decided to interview. So guys, this is an audition for that. And I want to turn to you. I know you weren't expecting this, but bear with me. Andrew, if you were giving an opening argument in a case, and let's just assume right now for my question that Donald Trump is the defendant and the charges are, the insurrection charge, the obstruction of a congressional proceeding charge, and the two conspiracy charges, conspiracy to defraud the United States as well as a conspiracy to submit the false statement of the electors. Imagine that you're doing your opening statement and what you have is what was put forward, the narrative put forward in this report. You don't have to give me your opening statement now, but what would be important for you to convey to the jury?
It's a little different whether it's an opening or a closing because
you choose. You want to do the closing? Do the closing.
Yeah, I think, you know why I think that's a little different? Because in an opening, you're technically, and especially if you're in the government, it's not just technically, but you will feel morally obliged to stay within the rules that are that you only can talk about what the evidence will show. You don't get to make argument. Now, on the defense side, that is very, you know, honored in the breach, and I'm not in any way casting aspersions on that. You know, defense lawyers have a different sort of obligation to sort of go as far as they can within those rules and to just only stop when the judge says, okay, that's enough argument in your opening. But anyway, I think I think there's one aspect that I would want to hit as one argument that I made actually when I was trying Vincent Giganti, who was the boss of the Genovese family. You might remember he was the boss who ran around in a bathrobe in Greenwich Village right near NYU, mm-hmm. my current stomping ground, and pretended to be incompetent for years and avoided prosecution as a result. And one of the things that we said was because there wasn't a lot of direct evidence about him, and a little bit like Trump and Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, these are people who don't use email. With Vincent Giganti, he, in addition to not using email or text or anything like that, he didn't allow anyone to mention his name. You had to point to your chin if you were talking to him because his nickname was Chin. But he knew that.
Just stop you for a second? And by doing that, if anyone was recording, they would only be capturing audio if there were wire. So
exactly.
So I'm touching my chin, but no one knows why or what.
Exactly. Okay, got you. And so one of the things that he knew was one of the ways you get in trouble is conspirators say something about you. And then that's admissible. So he was really, really careful. One of our best pieces of evidence was a Genovese soldier who was very close to Vincent Giganti, who had a conversation that he was recording with the underboss, the number two in the Genovese family. And we had instructed him to use Vincent Giganti's name to see what would happen. And one of our best pieces of evidence was as soon as he mentioned his name, he was immediately told, "What are you doing? Don't ever do that again." And we were like, "Why would you do that if he's just an incompetent vegetable?" Anyway, I'm somewhat digressing because everyone loves.
No, but I just don't. It's not a digression. It's really, really important because it's so interesting what you perceived or what the FBI perceived needed to be done to make those connections about knowledge. Anyway, but you can continue where you're going and you're closing.
Yeah. So I think that there's sort of. One point would be the importance of holding leaders responsible and not letting them get off by blaming and saying it's just foot soldiers and I didn't know anything about it. And yes, is there going to be more evidence with respect to the people who invaded the Capitol? Absolutely. But just because you're the person who ordered it or incited it and wanted it, that doesn't mean that you're not just as responsible. And so I think, and that there are going to be different levels of proof given their different roles. So I think you'd want to make sure that you conveyed that. And then, it depends what the proof is. I mean, if the proof is really good, you're going to be saying things like, you know what, he wants to say this is a political case, but it doesn't matter what his name is. It is totally irrelevant. Anybody who had ordered this would be prosecuted. And you know that because everyone who went to the Capitol, the foot soldiers are prosecuted. It doesn't matter what their motive was. It doesn't matter if they thought they were doing it for Trump. It doesn't matter if they thought that they just had some other conspiracy theory. It's like it's not about politics. It's about their actions and intent. And you sort of want to stress that. So that's an argument that is frequently made in court, which is, if you're trying somebody like, Peter Gotti, when he was tried, said, "Oh, I'm only here because I'm related to John Gotti." And I remember the prosecutor said, no, let's assume his name is Peter Smith. He would still be here.
I just realized, did I say sedition instead of insurrection when I asked you about the charges?
You said insurrection.
Okay, good. So I want to direct you, though, before I move to Jill, on this closing, if we're doing the closing, depending on what the, evidence showed during the course of the trial, of these charges, to me, the most important one is insurrection, because that sends a message that the insurrection charge links Donald Trump to the physical violent attack on the Capitol, whereas the obstruction And the conspiracy charges might only deal with that other thread, the thread of with the electors and those other pieces. How hard, based on what you have seen in this report, do you think it is to make the insurrection closing argument? Like, based on, if you assume that all the evidence that you saw in this report could be presented at trial?
Well, just to fight the hypothetical,
go ahead.
I suspect by the if this is charged, that there will be substantially more evidence than what we've seen. And just to give one example, there were various assertions of executive privilege, or even attorney-client privilege, that I think the department's going to be able to cut through. And by getting to court and doing that in connection with grand jury appearances, there are just ways to develop that evidence and that is no criticism at all of the January 6th committee. They just didn't have those same tools. But assuming that it's comparable, I do think that insurrection is, you know, it's in some ways is a more substantial charge, but I have to say, obstructing Congress is, especially when, you know, we're not talking about somebody who just yells during a hearing to help disrupt what people are doing. I mean, this is, it is obstructing to overthrow the will of the people.
Listen, I read from cover to cover at least once the Mueller report, and I was impressed by the obstruction case set out in volume two. I'm sure you're well aware of what I'm talking about, but yes. I've come to the conclusion that there is some memo on file that says that Bill Barr referenced maybe in that some letter that says a sitting president can never obstruct. Otherwise, why hasn't Merrick Garland charged Donald Trump for that? But I'm not. That's more of a. I'm leaving that sitting there, and you can answer it, and then I'm gonna go, Jill.
So I do think that there's the hardest part of that is connecting Donald Trump to sort of the connective tissue to the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. In a sort of direct way, there is connective tissue. There clearly was some sort of communication on January 5th. There's communications at the Willard Hotel. I mean, there are pieces, but it's not fleshed out. And so, from a criminal perspective, you know, you would, if you can, want to know that in order to convey it. But I do think that if you look at the overall picture of what was happening, to me, what I would argue is if you want to know what his intent is at the moment that the Capitol was being attacked, if you want to know his intent, look at his reaction.
The 187 minutes, is that the number?
Yes. And then I also would use the false statement to Kevin McCarthy. I mean, one of the people I would put immediately in the grand jury if I were Jack Smith is Kevin McCarthy. If, you know, if he's not willing to just come and tell you about
what
it.
What false statement are you? Which one?
So he said, Kevin McCarthy says, I had a conversation with the president where the president says, well, it's Antifa. And Kevin McCarthy reportedly said, who do you think you're talking to? That is such great evidence because it's his falsely claiming who's there, and you know that's not the case. So, why would you be doing that if you didn't totally encourage and want to see this happen? So, I think that I think there is a basis to go forward on that, but I think I would certainly be able to present the case. I would want to see a little bit more, but I think we may get there.
Okay, so Jill, you can take opening or closing, or if you're tired of opening and closing, the next thing I was going to move on to is the witnesses you would call, but why don't you take a crack at what you would do in the opening or closing?
Yeah, I like that. I want to start first with a similar story to Andrew's about a defendant trying to evade trial. And I had some mafia hitmen who had traveled from Boston to California to to commit a murder and ended up, the FBI actually sort of intervened because they were afraid that it would actually happen. They had trailed him and they disrupted it and they got charged with perjury instead. And one of the defendants on the eve of trial decided that he just wasn't going to go to trial, and he walked in front of a car, ended up in the hospital with a damaged leg. And the judge said to me, "I don't believe this. You call and get the doctor to tell you what he needs." And the doctor said, "Well, he needs to have his leg elevated." And the judge said, "Fine, I'll give him a chair and a pillow. He doesn't have to stand when I come in. He's going to trial to tomorrow." So we went to trial the next day. So there you go. Crazy, crazy mafia defendants. But I think I would take the opening.
Wait. That should be a new TV show. Crazy Mafia Defendants. I'm writing it down. Crazy
okay.
Mafia.
Andrew and I are going to co-write it.
It sounds good. Go ahead.
In terms of the opening, I think the thing that's missing is, and the thing that's wrong with the book is it's called January 6th. This is not January 6th. And the thing I would do in the opening is I would set the context. This is a coup attempt that started way before the election with, if I lose, it's fraudulent. Of course, if I win, it's legitimate. It continued with the Eastman, with the Clark, with the fake electors, the whole nine yards. And it's only in that context that you can see the criminality of each of these various things that are charged. And the charges, to me, insurrection is the most important, but not because of anything other than it would bar him from holding office ever again.
Right.
And
under
to me,
14,
that's the most important
three.
Thing. Okay. I'm truly worried, upset, disturbed, frightened that he might.
Jill, and so, can I ask you a question about that, which is, do you think that the department might bring that charge but not seek that remedy? In other words, that in order to not be viewed as political, they wouldn't seek that? Or do you think they'd feel compelled to bring that as a remedy? And what's your view on whether they, if they do bring that charge, they
And before you answer, let me just back up and just make sure we're all talking about the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. I think the Constitution needs to be protected and that the country needs to be protected and that the facts as we know them, and I agree, Andrew, there are many that we don't know, and I'm sure that using the tools available through a grand jury, through everything that the FBI and the Department of Justice can invoke, that there will be much better information than we currently have. But even taking what we have, I believe circumstantial evidence is extremely compelling. It's often more compelling if someone sees you coming in with a wet umbrella and wet shoes, they know it's raining outside. It's circumstantial. You didn't say it was raining. They didn't see it was raining, but everybody knows it was raining. And if you look at the Manafort trial, even the most loyal Trumper on the jury said, "Well, I was sworn as a juror to make my decision based on the evidence in this case. And the evidence was clear. I had to vote to convict him on all counts. But I love Trump. I believe everything he says. But, you know, as a juror, I had a different duty." So I think that the case is pretty strong, that there would be a conviction. I think that the remedy has to be what is set forth. And, you know, do I think the president should go to jail? Well, I think he deserves to go to jail. Do I think he will go to jail? No, I don't. I think it's unseemly. But I do think he could be barred from running for office. That seems to be an obvious thing. Now, he's doing his best to make sure he loses anyway because his campaign is pathetic and he's pathetic. But that's a different issue.
On this, before we get to your opening argument, just back to this, do you need to even ask for that remedy? I have friends who work at the organization Free Speech for People, and they were some of the folks who are trying to get Marjorie Taylor Greene to be excluded from the ballot in Georgia. And do you even need that remedy to be sought in court if he's found to have been guilty of insurrection, then wouldn't it just be people would bring these individual cases to the Secretary of State's office to keep him off the ballot? I know that's messy, but it might avoid some of the stuff you're talking about, Andrew.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I don't necessarily see that it's political to do that. It is the law. And the Department of Justice makes decisions based on the law and the facts. And
well, that's aspirational, Jill. But the current Department of Justice sometimes makes some unusual choices about special counsels. But that's another. Okay, let me get you back to.
Or about representing Donald
opening.
Trump.
Right.
In the Jean Carroll case.
Yeah. So let's go back to your opening. So I like this idea that you said, you know, you want to make sure that this gets framed as a coup for which the attack on the Capitol was just one tool toward Trump attempting to stay in office. And there are other illegal methods that you would want to describe.
Exactly. I mean, I would, as part of the proof of all of the things that you have identified as the charges we would be bringing, I think every single one of the elements of the coup attempt. And I think, frankly, it's not just for a trial. I think it's for the media right now to stop calling this January 6th. Mm. That is way too narrow a definition of what the threat to our country is. And that you need to be talking specifically about the fake electors, about the pressure on Pence, about the pressure on the Department of Justice. All of those things were using the mechanisms of power that Donald Trump had as president. And, you know, it goes back to the charges in the Watergate case, which were, you know, let's use the CIA to stop the FBI from investigating the money trail. Because, of course, they knew that the money trail would show that the campaign had paid for the burglary. The burglar's cash came from a campaign check. And it would have been so easy to immediately prove the connection. And that's using the levers of government. So it wasn't the break-in, but it was the cover-up, and it was all the elements of the cover-up that really matter. And that's, unless you see all of these things in the context. So my opening would go through all of the things and all of the evidence of his knowledge as well. I mean, remember, everybody was telling him you did not lose. The courts had told him you didn't lose eventually. But even before he brought the lawsuits, and the lawsuits are probably the only thing he did that was legal, although possibly sanctionable. I mean, we now know he was sanctioned for over almost $1 million because of bringing a frivolous lawsuit. These were frivolous. They had no basis in fact. And so they might be sanctionable, but it's not criminal. But everything else that he did was criminal. So
let me be a little bit of a lawyer, because even though I was trying to, you know, dramatically say how important the insurrection charge was, it seems clear to me the most solid one and easiest one to prove before a jury, at least, is the obstruction. And as
yes.
we know, generally speaking, obstruction, you need an obstructive act, you need a nexus with an official proceeding, and then you need the corrupt intent, right? And if anyone wants to see the different types of obstruction charges that are possible and the elements of proof, Volume 2 of the Mueller report, which I'm sure Andrew had a hand in, which I actually included in my casebook on white collar crime, is so good on that point. But this is kind of a technical question, but let's say an indictment comes down. I've seen cases where defendants challenge an indictment. Do you think Donald will challenge the indictment? And I don't know, does that put things on hold? And even if he doesn't challenge it or successfully challenge it, could there be, you know, there's always could be an appeal. And I am still very nervous about on the obstruction charge that he's going to somehow say presidents, you know, he's going to try somehow fight it because he's going to say either, sitting president can't obstruct, which doesn't really apply in this case because he wasn't going about the ordinary course of his work, hiring, firing people, but also that he might argue, I didn't have a corrupt intent because I had these lawyers telling me that this was a legitimate legal argument that I can make specifically around the vice president having the authority to just throw out the electors or throw out the electors and allow these, you know, alternative fake electors in. What do you Jill, what do you say about that on appeal? And then Andrew.
I don't think that that will fly. I think that a court would say, no, the evidence and the facts that you knew were such that you could not rely on that. And that you were told, particularly about the Eastman stuff,
yes,
was, yeah, that's illegal. What we're proposing is illegal. So
and Eastman even said he'd lose 9-0
right,
at SCOTUS. So how
right,
can that be legal?
Right. Yeah. So I think that there's just no way that that is going to matter. Will he appeal? Yes. Will it be successful? No. Will it accomplish delay? Yes. But other than the delay, I think America will feel better once an indictment is out there and that they will feel more trust in the Department of Justice for taking on. And I'm not suggesting that this is an easy decision. I have always believed that a sitting president is indictable. I do not think there is any merit to the OLC opinion, the Office of Legal Counsel opinion, that says you can't indict a sitting president. It's wrong. It needs to be changed. It needs to be challenged. I don't know who's going to do it, but I hope that someday it will be gone. And certainly a non-sitting president can be indicted. And we know that the criminal, I mean, U.S. v. Nixon shows that the executive privilege is not a unbreakable thing. It bows to the needs of the criminal system. And so I just don't think there's any, I don't see that as a risk. What about you,
but Andrew?
Andrew,
Jill said other than delay, but let's look at the clock. I mean, what's it going to look like when he is the nominee for his party for the presidency? How long could this delay go on? Could he be elected and pardon himself? Ignore Georgia for a second.
We're just focusing on the federal charges.
Yeah,
state charges, the clock is less important because a pardon can't affect that. Just on the substance, I think that it's likely that an appellate court, if it gets to them after a conviction, is going to say this was a factual issue. You raised an issue that you didn't have this intent, that you had a good faith argument, that you relied on counsel, and that you presented all of that to the jury. They were properly instructed that if they believed you didn't have this intent, that they had to acquit. The government had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That means the government's going to have to show that. Sorry, my dog is having
a... It's not mine today. Yes.
That's not my dog is outside my door. And
yeah.
Your dog is unhappy about the delay right now.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's sort of a factual issue, and an appellate court would say, well, you presented all that and the jury rejected it. So that's not for them to then reconsider that, assuming that there's any factual basis for it. And there clearly is. On the issue of delay, that is, I have constantly said, please, can everyone focus on the clock here? because if the next president is a Republican, whether it's Trump or not, there's just such a substantial likelihood of a pardon.
oh my God. That's it. Sorry, I just had this revelation. Am I the dumbest person in the world? But this is what it is. Trump is going to gather as much political power as he can, and then he is going to, would he actually, if he gets indicted, if someone kisses the ring by saying, I will pardon you if I'm elected, is he going to throw all of his support behind that person? I'm the stupidest person, of course, right?
Yes.
God.
Of course. Either he wants to, I mean, he's right now, he is thinking about jail. Right. And that's why Georgia, if I'm his defense lawyer, I am focused first and foremost on Georgia and maybe a little bit on Manhattan, which I still think is a little bit of a sleeper. I won't say I know that they're going to charge, but
we can go there. Jill, if you're fine with it, I think this is important. Let's detour, if you want, to Georgia after you've made this clock comment, Andrew.
Yeah. So, look, I think that one of the reasons I just want to say something critical of the department is I think they've done a wonderful job with the so-called foot soldiers, and that's not to minimize the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers cases are substantial, important cases.
Yes.
But they were late to the investigation of people who were As Tim Hafey referred to them as the white collar defendants as opposed to the blue collar defendants. And the problem with the clock is, you know, the idea of bringing an indictment in the middle of the campaign and then actually getting to trial and getting to trial before the next presidential election seems like an impossibility.
Hello, it's 2023. I mean, right?
But, you know, and this is, again, not to, you know, things are apples and oranges, but, you know, Jill has worked on the most important, so-called special counsel case. And I worked on, you know, maybe the latest one. And I can say, yes, things can be complicated. I mean, just to relate it to Enron, which wasn't a special counsel investigation. Now, that was a complicated case.
Oh, yes. But,
you know, we started in January, and our first charges were in March and in June. And Andy Fastow was indicted in September. I mean, I just think...
Is that 2001 or 2002? I'm trying to...
That was in 2001 was the collapse, and in January 2002 was when the Enron Task Force was created.
Amazing.
It was in December of 2001.
Amazing.
Then Arthur Anderson was charged, I believe, it was the end of March. Michael Copper, who was the right hand to Andy Fastow, the chief financial officer, in June. By the way, I'm not saying I take any full credit for this. I was a part.
No, but it's a model. It's a model. Other than the Arthur Anderson thing, which was not exactly the department's
complicated.
Fault. Complicated. Yes. Yes. Yes.
You know, and you know, Robert Mueller's come in for a lot of abuse and attacks, and maybe some of it's warranted. But I just want to say, you know, he was definitely, in terms of speed, he's born to that, and he felt it as an obligation to the public that we get in and out, that we do our work as thoroughly as possible and make decisions as fast as possible. So, I mean, he drove himself so hard.
I think he did a great job. And when I saw the letter that even Barr's letter, I could tell that this report was damning. The press did not understand what they were being told. And maybe we can blame the way it was communicated, but I mostly blame Bill Barr because that was a very damning report. But anyway, but back to...
In
terms of speed, can I just say, we were appointed in May of 73... and the trial was over, and that included the tapes hearing, it included going to the Supreme Court. The conviction was January 1st of 75. That's incredibly fast.
That's amazing.
And it was a different era. And it was an era where we had only three networks rather, and they all had the same facts, and Republicans were bipartisan. They are the ones who actually got involved and said to the president, you have to resign. We see the evidence and you'll be convicted in the Senate on the charges of impeachment.
Right.
So it was a different era, but this delay doesn't have to happen. And, you know, very good defense lawyers were involved in every aspect of the Watergate case, both, the trial and the tapes hearing.
What the delay also does is it kind of, for me, it makes you forget. Like in revisiting the report for our conversation today, I felt sick all over again. And I freaked out all over again because the big lie is alive and well. We had an attempted coup in this country, and the people who supported it, who deny it, who have the revisionist history, are running the House of Representatives. And it's and the violence. And it is all so upsetting. And until we can't have a country with half the people thinking, no big deal, it didn't happen, and the other half thinking, we had an attempted coup and there's no justice. I mean, we're in a very, very weird space, I think.
But Jen, to your point about you forget it and it sort of, you get anesthetized to it. I mean, what had just happened with Meta, in my view, is an example of that, because you have an example of, oh, listen, you just engaged in a coup, but you know what? It's been 2 years, so we're going to forget it. let's bygones be bygones, or to quote Susan Collins, you know, it's like, did he learn his lesson? I mean, you know, it's to me.
And just to be clear, in case the names change in the future, Meta is the parent company for Facebook and Instagram, and they have announced that Donald Trump can come back on. And it's right. It's like, okay, well, time has passed, and so no big deal. And I something Joyce Vance, our friend, all of our friends, said last night on, I don't even know. Oh, she was on with Nicole Wallace. She just said, this is a failure of institutions. The fact that Meta can let him back on, it's a failure of the, the Department of Justice. It's also a failure of the Republican Party that they didn't push this to the margins. I mean, I'm just, you know, it's flat. I'm flabbergasted.
Yeah, I also think it's a failure. I think Meta basically saw that the House now had subpoena power and was going to investigate liberal bias. And I think this was totally self-protective. I'm super cynical. I mean, it shows such a lack of moral character. I mean, the idea that you can engage in insurrection and an overthrow of democracy, but that was two years ago. Who cares now? I mean, it's just unbelievable. I didn't realize there was a time clock on that kind of crime.
I mean, can you imagine?
But it also isn't just 2 years ago. It's going on right now. Right. Yes, that's the problem.
Totally right. Jill, you're totally right.
Okay, so I know the book that was our launching point is this thing called the attack on the Capitol, the report on that. But we've already stepped back and said, no, this is about the coup and the ongoing coup, but it's also about criminal justice. And I want to turn to what's going on in Fulton County. And, in full disclosure, we're talking today, it's Thursday, January 26, 2023. And just a couple, although this will be airing on the Sunday after that. And there's a possibility, slim though it may be, that between when we finish conversing and when this goes live, that there could be an indictment out of Fulton County. Maybe not. Maybe, we heard Fannie Willis, the prosecutor there, say that decisions about indictments in the investigation she's been running that focus on Donald Trump and others related to the votes in Georgia, that decisions were imminent. But a decision could mean a lot of different things, and so could imminent. In my mind, because I'm a pessimist, imminent means by the end of February. A friend I was speaking to yesterday thinks imminent means a matter of days. Can you read the tea leaves, Andrew, on this one?
Well, let me give you another reason why Fannie Willis may want to act sooner than later and not by the end of February, and that is, having listened to the very complicated legal argument, the judge could, any day rule against.
Sorry, legal argument and whether to reveal this report made by the special grand jury. Got it.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And you had the DA saying that don't reveal it at least now. I may have a different view once we make these imminent charges. So the judge could make a ruling at any moment that is adverse. And one way for her to just moot that all.
Sorry, be clear. By adverse, you mean let everything out there, including who these witnesses are, who flipped and all of that, right?
Exactly. To say, know what, you're saying don't reveal it now. I say that, well, I understand your policy goals in doing that. Legally, I can't support it. And I'm a judge. I'm not a policymaker. I'm going to let it be released. One of the ways that Fannie Willis can sort of have her cake and eat it too is if she makes this decision to who's getting charged quickly before the judge rules, it kind of moots it all out because she made it very clear her position on whether the report can then be made public will change. I mean, I can see that being a reason for her to move on a time frame that's faster than she might.
Can I ask a question? Because in her argument, and just so everybody understands what we're talking about, there is a special grand jury that does an investigation in Georgia. It doesn't have the power to indict. It then gets a report that goes to a indicting grand jury, a regular grand jury.
wait, though, because I read Lawfare's column, and it turns out there could be a parallel course at the same time, that there's already been a sitting grand jury. So, right, just to be clear on that.
Right.
It's not like you have to, okay, go ahead.
But there isn't an indictment now, and someone has,
that's right.
A different grand jury has to indict.
Yes.
And so the issue is, this report, will it be available to the public, to the press? And the press has obviously brought this lawsuit saying, we need it. The public has a right to know. We should see it. The issue, and people have focused on her word imminent, which to me does mean much sooner than the end of February, although I don't know days, but sooner than the end of February.
Okay.
And she referred to an argument that said, it's not fair to future defendants to reveal this. Now, that could be, if you reveal this report, future defendants will not feel secure in grand juries, witnesses won't feel secure in grand juries. It could be that there are 10 people named in this report who the grand jury is recommending be indicted. And by the way, this special grand jury also said it should be made public. And that not all of them will be indicted because she does not believe that the evidence is sufficient against everybody that they think, and that it wouldn't be fair to them to be named, which means it also wouldn't be fair to name them after the indictment comes out, not naming them. So I don't know, and yet she seemed to say, well, after the indictment, it's okay. So what do you think? Is it fair to have your name, you know, people get investigated by grand juries all the time, and they don't all get indicted because the evidence doesn't pan out. You don't want their names to be known because that ruins their reputation, and there was nothing there. But once you're under investigation, there's some suspicion of you, a la Comey and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of thoughts. One, Georgia law is so backwards from federal law because, you know, federal law, there's grand jury secrecy for all the reasons that Jill points out. And I should point out, like, Justices Marshall and Brennan were huge proponents of grand jury secrecy because of its sort of civil liberties and protective qualities. And so that was sort of what Fani Willis was sort of getting at. I do think that there's an interim solution for her, though, because if there are people who are sort of named who she decides not to charge, she could take the position that you can now release a redacted version of the report, but you shouldn't be able to release more. And I also think that the judge, I would think, should give notice to those people so that they can be heard without them having to identify who their client is. You know, so, but I mean, that to me, that happens from time to time when in the special counsel, we had lots of issues where you have to, somebody wants to claim attorney-client privilege or executive privilege, and you have sealed proceedings where the person who's got the interest gets to be heard by the court. But that would be a way of accomplishing that goal of not besmirching somebody who has never been charged. I have to say, I'm not really a fan of this whole idea of a report that gets public. I mean, it's just an oddity, at least, you know, in all of my sort of federal training, which is, you know, the sort of put up or shut up. It's like you either are indicting or you're not supposed to talk.
Right. Although I will say in Watergate, we were given permission by the court to breach grand jury secrecy, to turn over the evidence to the House for impeachment purposes, because of our inability to indict the president. And therefore, it was, you know, the argument was, well, you can't indict him, but that's because there's a impeachment process that is meant to take care of the president. And therefore, rather than having the House Judiciary Committee have to reinvent the wheel, we gave them all the information. So, but that was by special permission. There is a special rule that allows grand jury to be turned over.
Yeah, very different. Like, that makes total sense that would.
Yeah, I am puzzled by that, this whole idea, though, even if she makes charging. So there's different things. There could be, I'm charging nobody. That doesn't seem likely. There's, you know, there's some charges and some, and everyone's included, or there's charges and some people on there aren't. But no matter what, for the people you're charging, why would you want to have that information out there? Because it's going to be harder to find a jury. There's all kinds of reasons why you wouldn't want the report in the open. So,
although in a speaking indictment, you would put that information in. So,
right.
You know, as long as it's in the indictment, it's okay.
It also gives her some, you know, just from
some
cover and also some legitimacy that this independent body takes in. You think that, you know, made these findings. And so having it out at the same time, especially if it doesn't go beyond the people who are charged and it's somehow redacted, that it does give her some, you know, helpful discussion of the case and findings.
Interesting. Okay, so you said the sleeper case in New York. I think you're talking about the Manhattan DA, but there's several Manhattan DA investigations. Let's start with you, Andrew. Talk about New York, and then Jill.
Well, Manhattan has been a lot of ups and downs, and if you remember, everyone was sort of very focused on it, and then we got a new Manhattan district attorney. There was an election, and the old
district. We lost Cy Vance, and got our Alvin Bragg.
Exactly. Yep. The next thing we heard is that two of the very esteemed prosecutors who were leading the matter sort of precipitously resigned. And one of them, there was a resignation letter that made its way into the press that basically said there was a prosecutable case against Donald Trump that you should have brought. And I have to say, personally, I was very betwixt in between because I knew a lot of the players. I dealt with the people who had resigned. I knew some of the people who were still at the office. And so I just thought, God, I wonder if this is just a disagreement. I mean, this is like...
And to be clear, this is a case that would have been maybe a superseding indictment to the case brought against the Trump Org and Weisselberg related to the under-the-table payments to add on maybe some of these other business records and other maybe bank fraud charges related to the under and overvaluation of different properties, right? Is that what you were thinking?
Exactly. Okay. And there are all sorts of state laws about false business records and when they can be misdemeanors and when they can be felonies. And so they have a whole panoply of possibilities. But that seemed to be moribund or dead when the two prosecutors left. And even though Alvin Bragg was saying the investigation is still continuing, people generally were like, I've heard that. But, you know, it was taken with a grain of salt. That being said, they then proceed and get Weisselberg to plead. And he has an unusual agreement where he is required to testify. And he does. And then there's a conviction against the two Trump organization.
Which was huge. We've already forgotten it, but that's tremendous.
Huge. Right? And it was a multi-year tax conspiracy with some direct evidence, by the way, that Trump was aware of it, which of course he was. I mean, it benefited him. Why wouldn't you tell him? I mean, this is the kind of thing you would want to get praise from your boss.
If you look in the original indictment, he's mentioned as, you know, signing the lease for the place that so Weisselberg could stay there, you know, so in his own organization on behalf of, so he knew what was going on.
Yeah. So now there are signs of things still progressing. So, but let me give you one possibility. Alan Weisselberg is now in jail, and he is not just in any jail. He is
Rikers.
Yep. Exactly. Which is, you know, nobody should really be in Rikers. It's just a horrendous prison. It is true that his sentence is only 5 months. But for somebody who's 75, for sort of a first time tax offense, that's not actually, unfortunately, out of the ordinary, even though it is a low sentence. But there is evidence of additional crimes you could be charged with. If you look at the Attorney General's civil case, that is Letitia James brought a huge civil case against many, many Trump people, entities, organizations. It's incredibly detailed. In this paragraphs 600 plus, this is a speaking complaint. There is direct evidence that Weisselberg lied to the Zurich Assurance Company on behalf of the Trump Organization in terms of its records and whether things had been audited, and did so repeatedly. And that's laid out. That seems like such a open and shut issue. So one of the things that you could imagine the DA's office doing is thinking, okay, why should he get a pass on this? And one of the really unusual things I thought when Weisselberg pled is that he did not get cover for any other crimes. Usually when you are a defense lawyer, you say, okay, he'll plead, but I want peace. I don't want him to be able to be charged, you know, for other things that are related to this. And the prosecution tends to say, okay, but we have to cabinet to certain areas. Like, I'm not going to give him cover for a murder, for instance. But usually there is a dialogue to figure out the scope of coverage that you give somebody. Here, there was no coverage whatsoever for any additional crimes other than what he pled to. And so it is still very open to the DA's office to bring those charges. You know, this is speculation in the sense I don't know if they're going to bring it or not bring it, but that is still a possibility. And then the final point is, the one thing I can sort of calculate is that I think the statute of limitations for the state cases sort of begin to run in sort of the May timeframe. So I also think we will have a sort of thumbs up.
Because there was that extension because of COVID, is that why?
Exactly. There's also another reason, which is that for Trump, if you're not a resident in this, if you move out of state, there's also a tolling. And as you recall, he moved his residence to Florida. So there's sort of two grounds to deal with that. But the COVID one is really neat and clean and has been upheld by the courts.
So, Jill, I'm sorry to cut you off, Andrew. Jill, back to the, still at the New York, Manhattan DA, there's also coming back the whole Stormy Daniels payments. Are they going to do anything about that?
Well, Michael Cohen has been a busy man. And before I answer that, I want to just add to what Andrew said, which is that Weisselberg not only didn't get cover, he also didn't have to testify against Trump. His agreement was that he would testify against Trump org. And to me, that's, it's something. The conviction's meaningful. But his cooperation didn't deserve a lot of credit as far as I was concerned in terms of sentencing. He got too light a sentence. But that's a separate issue. It's also, I want to say, it's a sad thing that we're talking about how the state could bring these charges, because every state tax fraud involves a federal tax fraud. Mm-hmm. So where is the federal government? He's been under audit since 2015 for a deduction he took. And what's happened to that case? It's over. And why? We don't know. I can understand it's being delayed while he was president because he ran the IRS and, of course, the Department of Justice. They weren't going to continue that case against him. There would be no chance of anything happening. But it's 2 years since he hasn't been president, and there's still nothing. So the federal government is, as Andrew said before, it's, Georgia's probably ahead of them. Merrick Garland was really delayed in doing anything and continues to be delayed. And the U.S. attorney, the same thing. So,
Andrew mentions, and you talk about Tish James is the civil suit brought by the state
for attorney general. $250
million. Right, which is the biggest thing that's more than anything he has ever faced before or paid out. I think $25 million is what he paid out in the civil RICO case. But, that was a speaking, in fact, a shouting indictment, especially footnote one, that waved and said, hey, SDNY, you got some bank fraud, you got some false statements to a financial institution. Take a look at these. Obviously, the Sovereign District of New York is still part of the Department of Justice, but I haven't heard boo out of that. Maybe they've been very quiet, but my Lord, it's like we don't have a federal criminal apparatus at this point. What's going on?
It's distressing. I don't know.
But when Weisselberg pled, he admitted in his plea agreement that this scheme also violated federal law. I mean, I have never seen the state so clearly at the Attorney General and Manhattan level say, by the way, this is a federal crime.
By the way. So we only have a little bit of time. And to wrap things up, you know, I wanted to sort of be freestyle. You know, I started out by saying, you know, this is your audition. This is your interview. I've hired you. What's the first thing you're going to, what do you do now? Like, who is the witness? You know, I guess two things. One, I want to ask this witness question, and then, you know, anything else you'd like to say before we go. The witness question is, who is the best, or who are the two or three best witnesses at the federal level for the coup case, the insurrection slash obstruction slash conspiracy case against Donald Trump? Who do you predict, who would you want to have, no matter what, as your witnesses? Jill.
Well, I think I can only answer that based on the witnesses that we've seen in the hearings, the unfortunately called January 6th hearings. Let's call them the coup hearings, because they ended up actually concluding there was a much broader, but they still called it January 6th. And there are all those that evaded service and evaded testimony, or who have cooperated, like Meadows, a little bit. Very importantly, gave significantly important information. The text messages are devastating evidence. Mm-hmm. But if you could flip him, he clearly is someone who was always in the room, both at the Willard Hotel, both in the Oval Office. He would be really significant. People who were important in the January 6th, like Cassidy Hutchinson, it's all hearsay mostly. So it's not, her testimony, a lot of it wouldn't be admissible in an actual trial.
So Meadows is the guy that if he would sing, this would be done. Oh. Why won't he?
Well, he hasn't been pressured enough, obviously. He hasn't, you know, the House did not have the tools that the Department of Justice has. And so it's time.
Let me ask you this, Andrew. If you want to, and you can say your person too, but if you want to get Mark Meadows or whoever else, does Jack Smith have those tools, or does he have to wait until later for Merrick Garland to take the recommendation?
No, he has the tools. And by the way, Mark Meadows is clearly has the keys to the case. I mean, he is, you know, he just related to Enron. He is like flipping the chief financial officer. I mean, he is like, you know, if you're wanting to get into the very top echelon.
He's the Fastow of the Trump organization.
Yeah, he is just exactly who he would want. This is what we were hoping Manafort would be. I mean, this is a classic thing. You work your way up, you indict people and you pressure them and you flip them. One of the unusual things here is we haven't seen any of that. Zero. I mean, we've seen it only at the foot soldier level. We have not seen any. I mean, to give you a sense of like sort of how late this is that there hasn't been any sign of that process of flipping people. And the House, to its credit, I mean, they referred Mark Meadows to the Justice Department for prosecution for contempt.
And they didn't do anything.
You know,
do you think they have him already?
I don't. I used to be a little bit more optimistic, but I don't think they do. So the key thing you do is you build a case. Now, that's where Cassidy Hutchinson can be very useful, because she does have direct evidence against him. And, you know, but by the same token, I'm going to put it the other way. If you're Donald Trump, the witnesses that you want is, you know, you're going to be looking at the report for the ways Cassidy Hutchinson lied in her first interview. She has very good reasons for it. You're going to look for it, to your point, Jen, Eastman and what he told the president about a legal theory and his and so you can argue, well, he decided to believe that. And so you're going to look for as many lawyers and, you know, people providing evidence so that you can counteract the slew of witnesses who are going to say, that didn't happen. I personally think the best evidence in all of that is, but wait a second, you had 60 courts. I mean, in other words, if you want to say that this, you had a factual basis, I don't understand. You had 60 times to go to court and not a single one worked. So stop telling me that you believed it, because you know what? Maybe the first time, okay. The second time a judge, the third time, 60 times. I mean, you know, you can imagine the, you know, the closing argument for the government on this. So then you have all the witnesses who are privately telling him that he lost, or to Bill Barr, this is bullshit. You know, this, it's just going to be a very compelling case that he knew that he had lost.
I, you know, it's so interesting because Manafort, I get why he wouldn't flip, because when you have, you know, Russian organized crime who could kill you, or you could sit in jail and wait for a pardon, I get that. As Stone seems like he's very, you know, would succumb to whims, but it turns out that he got his commutation. When it comes to Mark Meadows, I don't see as much downside in flipping. I don't know why they can't get to, why the feds can't get his attention. Maybe because he doesn't see serious charges ahead of him.
If he doesn't see charges to himself, that's why he's not flipping. So they have to make a case against him. Roger Stone, who I've known since Watergate, will never flip because he's totally, I mean, I don't throw around words like loony often, but he's in a different world than we are, and he will never flip. He would rather go to jail than he would flip. It's just not in his character. So he I'm sure knows a lot about the connection between the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, but don't count on him for that. I'd count on Ali Alexander or Stuart Rhodes to flip first, and I don't expect them to do so either.
Wow. Okay. So, on a happy note or hopeful note, what are your final words, Andrew, on any of this? Your predictions, your hopes. You know, any way to wrap this up in a way that makes us hopeful about the rule of law and the future of democracy, or not?
Well, I do think, regardless of, to be optimistic, regardless of the Department of Justice's history of sort of how we got here, I do think that it is in the right place now. I do think I have a lot of respect for Jack Smith and his team and his being appropriately aggressive. So they think, if you're looking at sort of where we are and going forward, I think that's really useful. And although there is the possibility of federal pardons, in some ways, you know, whatever that is, it will happen, but it doesn't mean that you don't charge if that's the right thing to do. And so I do think that there will be a thorough and complete investigation at the federal level. And, you know, I think that at least in Georgia, I think it seemed all the tea leaves are, it seems highly likely that we're going to see a charge imminently, with respect to Donald Trump.
And Jill.
I agree with Andrew. In terms of Georgia, I'm really confident that it will include former President Trump, because he's on tape and you can't possibly indict anyone else. And there was that word defendants, if you don't indict the person who was speaking the words of just give me. And nobody could believe that he had any legitimate belief that that wasn't, that that was true, that he legitimately had more votes. So I think that one will come imminently. I think that I opposed a special prosecutor because I love the Department of Justice. I believe they can do this kind of investigation, and I thought it demeaned them in a way. But because of the delay that we saw from Merrick Garland and the speed that we're now seeing and the attention that's being paid to this, I am very glad that we have a special counsel. And I am hopeful that he will come to some speedy conclusions. And I'm satisfied if the indictment is for obstruction of Congress, interference in a proceeding. I would like to see the insurrection for the reasons I said about removing him from the possibility of being president again. But I am optimistic that a jury will convict in the same way that even a Trump-loving juror would convict Manafort. And, you know, frankly, in D.C., you know, getting a Trump-loving juror is less likely. So that makes it even more optimistic for me that there will be a trial.
Well, friends, too, so that I don't jinx all of this hopefulness, I'm not buying a Fonnie Willis votive candle or a Jack Smith action figure. I'm just going to rely not on superstition or gimmicky tchotchkes. I'm just going to listen to your words, remain hopeful, try to look up what the word imminent means yet again, and just wait out for the tweet from a friend that tells me, OMG, indictment. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Wow. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I remain hopeful that we actually see the rule of law prevail and an indictment of Donald Trump imminently in Georgia, in New York, and at the federal level. Thank you so much for listening to this team. I swear we really should do a podcast or television show called Crazy Mafia Defendants. Let me know if you like that idea. If you do, send me an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.